All right, welcome once more to CSE 75 section. Quick announcement before we begin. So for this week, I've resurrected the Gmail account / AIM account. So that is cs75section@gmail.com, or by AIM, just cs75section. So I heard that it wasn't used too much when Jesse was providing it, but you know, if you have a question that you'd like to ask, I think I'm going to run a little under time today, so I'd love it if people participate a little bit, even if they can't be here physically, and ask some good questions. So anyway, that's up to you if you want to use that or not, but it's there, and I'll try to check it periodically and answer whatever questions come up. So the plan for today is, first of all, I think I'm going to go over a little bit of what I cut short last week, which was the final part of putting together your JavaScript Google Maps mashup. So I got through the part about the geocoding and the part about creating the Google map, but I didn't talk so much about what you're actually going to be querying with the AJAX, the PHP page you're going to need to write to grab the markers, or rather grab the cities and grab the news for those cities. So I'll go over that in a little bit more detail if people have questions about that, because I've been getting some emails about that. And then we'll go into some more interesting AJAX examples. I'm not going to be rehashing what I did 2 weeks ago, but I will be showing you, for example, how to do AJAX queries with different libraries. So instead of just doing the default built-in AJAX type of query, you can also use the UE AJAX library, or you can also use the the Google Maps AJAX library. So those are a couple of alternate ways to do exactly the same thing with perhaps some nicer syntax. So as usual, before I begin, does anyone have any questions or concerns about the project, or just things in general, JavaScript, AJAX?
I have several questions concerning the project. I'm not sure what you're going to get to or not. What is the UE connections?
Okay, so the UE connections is just an alternative way of doing AJAX queries. You don't need to use it if you don't want to, but the syntax is maybe a little bit nicer. You don't have to use, for example, one of the things you have to do with a normal AJAX query is check whether the user is using Internet Explorer or Firefox or some other browser by doing kind of the try-catch block and trying to instantiate the object two different ways. But if you use the UE library or the Google Maps library to do it, you don't need to do that stuff because it's encapsulated within the library and done invisibly. So it just kind of makes it a little bit easier on you, and you know, there's less room for error, basically, because you don't have to do all kinds of little fiddly technical things. It's just taken care of. But you don't need to use it. It's just optional.
So according to my understanding, you get a connect with UE. It's a successful connect or whatever. And then it will fire off a function. You can tell it which function to fire off. In the class example, he has, inside of the parentheses, he has an argument for the function. He has an argument O. But where he calls the function, he doesn't provide any argument. Where does that argument come from?
Okay, so I'm going to actually be getting to that later on, so I'll postpone that until I actually go over that.
Okay.
But yeah, it should be pretty clear once I demonstrate the example. But I can see how that could be a little bit confusing with the arguments kind of appearing and disappearing. All right, anything else before I get started?
Someone wants to chat with you.
Huh? Does. Yeah, that's the pain about Gmail. You have to approve everyone's GChat. AIM is a little bit more convenient in that regard. But okay. So I'll assume I can move on. So what I want to talk about, as I said, first of all, is kind of the plan for this project. So last week we talked about, first of all, the setup, which was basically import. And then we also talked about sort of the first steps of the Google Maps process. So geocoding, or just in general, getting the user's input and transforming it into a spot on your map. And then there's kind of this gray area. And then we had marker creation. So what is it that goes in here?
AJAX query to the city's PHP or whatever.
Exactly. So here is where you have the AJAX query to cities.php or whatever you choose to call it. It's not actually important. So what kind of data does your map need from cities.php in order to be able to draw the markers for the area your user has selected?
Lat long or zip or something that can feed to a geocoder at least.
So does it need something you can feed into it?
You could use lat and long, latitude and longitude. Or you could use something with a geocoder, I would imagine.
So, yeah, I guess this can be, the order in which you do it is sort of important. So once you get to this point, you've done the geocoding, you have a latitude and longitude, which is generally kind of the language of Google Maps.
Yes.
So the data you want from this AJAX query is the cities themselves. You no longer need location information. What, like the map knows where it is.
For the markers, though. Don't you need a marker for each city? So they need a location, right?
Right. So the data, oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, so you want to get from this a latitude and longitude. You don't want to return back. I guess I can see how you could do that. You might want to return, you know, you could return zip codes from here and then geocode them again and get latitude and longitude that way, which would, that's an interesting way of doing it. But geocoding is maybe a little bit slower, resource intensive, the better way to do it generally is, since you have latitude and longitude in your database already, grab them from here. So that's definitely right. Like the first piece of data you want is where the markers are. That is to say, what cities fall into the latitude-longitude range that your Google Map passed to the AJAX query. So your Google Map is saying to your cities.php, my upper left corner is over here, point one, my lower right-hand corner is over here, and tell me what cities fall into this range. And your database knows this because you have latitude-longitude data for every city in there. Everyone okay with this so far? Okay. So, once you have what the cities or markers actually are, what do you want? What more data do you want? Is that enough?
Well, you need the RSS, at least title and URL, right?
Yeah. So, next thing you want is the news. So the way you're going to be doing this is basically you're building an XML response. Or, I mean, I suppose you could use JSON, but I think XML is a little bit more appropriate for this kind of response. We'll be talking about how to use JSON later in this section. Where you're specifying kind of hierarchically, you know, cities. You've got, you know, city one, city two, down to city five, or fewer if there's not five cities in the area. And then for each one of these cities, you want to have, let's see, kind of the name of the city, that is city state, and then news items. And as you alluded to, what the news items are is stuff you're going to be grabbing from the RSS feed. So you need the headline of the news item and the URL of the news item. But both of those are just themselves XML, which is in the RSS feed. So all you need to do is basically pull down that RSS file and then parse it as you would any other XML file, which you've done in PizzaML. And also, David has examples on the internet of from like week 3 or 4, pretty early on, of doing the same thing, grabbing RSS data and parsing it for his own purposes. So I'm not going to go into detail on that. But so does everyone see kind of how this works out? So once you've got all this stuff, this big XML block with data for each city, you're passing that back to your Google Map over here. And then using JavaScript, you're going to do DOM stuff with this XML and turn it into markers. So any questions on that?
I started. The 0.1, 0.2 box thing, what does that represent?
So what you're going to be passing to cities.php so it knows where to look is latitude and longitude, but you need two pairs to represent a box, right? So your map on the page would look like this. And you can specify where the map is, sort of, like what area it's covering, just using this point and this point, which are each latitude and longitude. So the Google Maps API provides a function called like get bottom left and
get bounds.
Yeah, it's get bounds or something. Basically, there's a function in there. You can look it up on the documentation pretty easily, which will return these points for you. Okay. And then once you have them, you can pass them in, you know, in the query string to your getCities.php, and then getCities.php can do in like the SQL query, you know, where latitude less than this, longitude less than this, and greater than this, or you know, other way around. But you get the idea. Or in fact, you could also use SQL between. The between keyword, which is a little bit nicer when you have two values that you want something to fall between, then instead of doing less than or equal to, greater than or equal to, which is a little bit more convenient. Okay. So does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess I was just confused a little on what we're showing.
But yeah, the notation was a little bit unclear, but basically, if this is your Google Map, you can call functions that will get these two points in terms of their longitude and latitude. And then once you have those, you can just pass them straight on into the database query, and it'll look through for the cities.
Okay.
By the way, anything else you need to do in this query you might get tripped up on? So you need cities between these two things, but what else do you need? What do you need to make sure about those cities? Suppose your map is zoomed out all the way, so you just see like the entire continental US. Do you want to just pick like alphabetically the first five cities beginning with A or something?
We were supposed to get the largest by population, weren't we?
Largest by population, right. So you need to make sure that you're also sorting, or specifically order by in SQL terminology, so that you actually get the top five biggest cities, or else you'll be in trouble because you'll just display five random cities, and that would be less than ideal. That makes sense, right? I see some confused faces. Okay. So with that out of the way, hopefully I've cleared up the remaining confusion that was left over from last week when I didn't finish. Let's talk about AJAX a little bit. So by now you're pretty familiar, if you watched the section from 2 weeks ago, with kind of the general format of an AJAX query, how you create one, how you send one, and then how you deal with it when it comes back to you with the actual data. And you might want to go back and review that if you've forgotten by now, because I did it a little bit out of order, so it may have been confusing at the time. But there are more ways you can do AJAX queries than just the one I showed that week. So first of all, here is the standard way to do it, which is what I demonstrated 2 weeks ago. So this is copied pretty much verbatim from one of David's examples this week. So we have our XML HTTP request object, which we initialized to null. And then, skip down to the bottom quickly, we have our form whose onSubmit is set to this quote function, which basically means when you credit submit this form, it's actually going to call the quote function using JavaScript. What does return false mean? Refresh my memory.
Will prevent your form from refreshing the page or launching a new page.
Exactly. So return false says, don't actually handle this. It says to the browser, don't handle this as you would a normal action. I've taken care of it. If you return true, on the other hand, the browser will continue through and actually submit the form. So an example of where you would actually use return true might be if you're validating a form on submission, whether you've returned true or false will determine, you know, if the form is okay, you can just pass it on through and let it go to the next step. Whereas the form, if the form is bad, you can return false there and the action won't go through, because the user needs to fix some of his input.
Is it syntactically correct to return a function and have the function return true or false?
Sure.
Okay.
You can absolutely do that. So anyway, so we have the user input the symbol, and then when they submit using the submit button, it calls quote. So what does quote do? As we've seen several times now, we use this try-catch block to do browser-independent instantiation. So if we're using Firefox or some other normal browser, you do the XML HTTP request, which is what the standard says. And if you're using Internet Explorer, you do the ActiveX object thing with Microsoft XML HTTP. They're completely identical in everything except the way you instantiate them. And then, of course, if it happens to be null, then they're using a browser too old to support AJAX at all. Both of these failed, essentially, is what that's saying. And then next up, we just construct our URL, which in this case is quote1.php, which presumably is some PHP page living on our server in the same directory. And then we provide the symbol as an element pulled from the page, from the user's input.
I do have a question on this line. If you want to make if you want to pass multiple variables, so not just symbol, how would you sort of concatenate them to have a longer get?
So the way you would do that is, I'll fire up Notepad or something to demonstrate. That's a good question. So if anyone didn't hear that, the question is, how do we provide multiple values to quote.php? So if you ever look at a query string, you'll notice that the format would be something like, you know, quote.php question mark variable 1 equals value 1 and ampersand variable 2 equals value 2. So likewise, on this page, you could do document.getElementById symbol value plus ampersand variable 2 equals, and then plus the value of something else, and on, so as long as you want. Good question, though. Everyone else okay so far? So then the next thing you do is set up the final parts of your query. You set the onReady state change function, which is a fancy way of saying the function that gets called when the AJAX query returns with actual data for you, presumably. Well, not necessarily, but the only time we care about it in this case is when it has data for us. We open the request, so we specify method get. We tell it to go to this URL, and this true means do it asynchronously, hence AJAX. Otherwise, it would just be JAX or something. And then we send it. And then we have the handler function, which handles it when it comes back. So if XHR ready state equals 4, meaning what? Everyone remembers?
It's got the connection returned.
Yeah,
it means response.
It means it's done. It starts out in state 0, which means you just created it. Then it proceeds through states 1, 2, 3, which means various, you know, like I think 1 is sent. And then there's, I don't know what all the numbers mean, but the point is 0 is just created and 4 is done. And then if status is 200, which means what? Where do we get the number 200 from?
Everything's good.
yeah, HTTP OK is 200 as opposed to numbers like 404, which are bad. Then we alert the response text. Otherwise, we alert that there was an error. And usually the times when there would be an error could be, say, if the server you're trying to contact for your query is down, you could get that error message. So, quick demo.
To go back, so you have function handler. You have XHR. Where does XHR come from?
So XHR is a global variable that we declared here at the top.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. This way they're all referring to the same XHR. If you just declared it locally in quote, then we wouldn't be able to refer to XHR so easily.
Right.
So put in symbol, I don't know, int C, get quote, and apparently it's worth $15. So simple enough. Any questions on that? All right, so instead of doing it with that kind of nasty regular old syntax where you have to deal with different kinds of browsers, we can also use the UE connections library to create our AJAX queries. So as with everything UE, you have to do some setup first of all, which basically means including these different scripts from Yahoo's site. And you can get these by just Google searching UE connections, and then the Yahoo page with the documentation will tell you exactly what you need to include. Once you've done that, you can write your JavaScript. Everything below this point is exactly the same, so I'm not going to demonstrate it. I'm just going to talk about the JavaScript. So we have, first of all, this callback object. What the callback object is kind of a more complicated form of the onReady state change member of XHR. So before we just had a single function which was always called no matter what was actually going on with the query. But behind the scenes, because we're using UE, UE can determine whether the query went OK or the query failed. And if it succeeded, we can use alert stock, or the thing after success colon. And if it failed, we can use alert error. What callback actually is basically a JavaScript object, which sets the function alert stock to success and the function alert error to failure, which is kind of weird syntax. But that's really all it's doing. And then in lecture, you also saw that underneath here, you can also have args, which basically means that when alert stock or alert error is called, it will have the array of args that you put here passed into it. So I mean, I'm trying to think of a situation where you might want args. Let's say, for example, you wanted to know how long a query took. So one thing you could do would be, and then I don't know off the top of my head what the JavaScript function is for the current date. I'll just call it date for the moment. I don't think that's right. Like that. And so then whenever alert stock or alert error was called, it would have this. Actually, would that give you the current date? Or I'm having trouble thinking of a situation where you would actually want args. But the point is, if you have different situations under which you're calling quote, but you don't want to have to write different functions for all those situations, you can simply have this quote function put in different types of args to this callback. So you could do something like callback beneath in the quote function. So quote callback.args equals, oh, this would work. So then you could have something like that, whatever the date function really is. And then this would set one of the arguments passed to these functions to be the current date at the time the query was actually sent. And then what you could do in alert stock, which would implicitly have these args passed to it, you could subtract the current date from the date that was passed in from quote and see how long the AJAX query took, for example. So that's kind of a lame example of the way you can use the arguments. But you know, if we sat around and brainstormed for 5 minutes, we could probably come up with more situations in which you would conceivably want some kind of data that you know at this point to be passed into these functions at the time when they're called. And again, the reason you might want to do that is just that you can have only these two functions that receive all kinds of successes and failures, and then depending on the args that were passed to them at the time they were called, at the time the AJAX query was generated, you can have them do different things instead of writing, you know, alert stock 1, alert stock 2, stuff like that. Does that make at least tentative sense? I'm sure one day when you're doing AJAX for the 500th time, you'll think, hey, I have a reason to use args now, and it'll all become clear. But
question, can you pass different arguments to the two success and failure?
No, the args will be passed to both, same args.
Okey-doke.
All right, so what's going on here? As before, once you click submit, the quote function is called. And as before, we set up our URL in exactly the same way as we did before. But now, you'll notice XHR is gone. We're not doing any of the stuff with XHR. We're not setting up for two different browsers. We're not setting up what the handler will be. We're not using open, none of that. All we're doing is setting var transaction to this expression here. So if you step through it, part by part, Yahoo. This just says it's the Yahoo namespace, something we got from Yahoo, not something we wrote ourselves. And then going down, util connect, just all hierarchical Yahoo stuff. And then finally, we get to async request, which is the actual function that's doing the work. And what async request will take is, just like XHR did, method get, then the URL, then our callback object, and then I can't remember off the top of my head what null is. I don't think you need it most. Oh, that's right. It's for post. Yeah. So most of the time, you really don't need that, since AJAX is generally done with get. And remember, this callback object we're passing in here is the callback we defined up here. So then we have our two functions, which are specified by the callback, alert stock and alert error. And they just do what was done before. They alert the response text if it succeeded, or error with the AJAX call if it failed.
You got there's that argument I was talking about. Function alert stock. Oh, where'd the O come from?
Right. So this O is automatically generated by stuff that happens inside the Yahoo async request.
Is it always O?
It's always O.
It's always O. Okay.
It's always O.
Okay.
So O is just an object that contains various useful things you would want to know. It's much like XHR, actually. But it contains some other properties as well. And they've kind of all been flattened into this O object, which is just stuff Yahoo thinks you'll want to know when your query comes back. So it contains response text, response XML. Probably, if you wanted, you could get status the same as with XHR. But yeah, that's all O is. And again, the reason for this is that since we didn't globally define XHR or anything like that, this is implicitly, this function here is implicitly creating an object for us that encapsulates the AJAX query. So we don't know what it's called ourselves because it's happening behind the scenes. And therefore, Yahoo tells us it'll be called O when you get to it. And then we say, OK, so I'll ask for stuff related to O.
Now, this O, it's a global variable then?
It's not a global variable. It's a every time alert stock is called, O is just passed to it by the Yahoo code. So O refers to whatever query is currently being processed, essentially.
Okay, so variable transaction goes to callback. Callback goes to either alert stock or alert. I see. Okay, so that's where it gets O from callback.
I mean, yeah, or rather, the Yahoo code says, I want to call functions from callback, either success or failure, with data about the query, whatever this query is, whichever one it is. And then it puts them together, and that's how you get alert stock O, alert error O.
Right on.
Okay, any other questions about this?
Do you always use callback?
It doesn't have to be called callback. It can be any object that provides success, failure, and then args if you want them.
Okay.
And in fact, I don't think you even have to provide failure if you don't want. But so anyway, just to demonstrate that this in fact does do the same thing. Get that. Oh, does Firefox not like this? Oh, there it is. Okay, just took a while. 1562 still. That's closing time, so probably hit it twice. All right. So in fact, this is pretty good. We've gotten rid of a lot of the nasty stuff associated with the XML HTTP response object that wasn't really useful to us. But we can do even better. So we'll move on to index 3. Or I'll check for questions from our Gmail friends first. Nothing?
Instead of callback, is there another way you could put like, a success and then a function in that line? I thought I saw something like that in a class example.
So
where instead of having something like callback, he had success, comma, something else, maybe, or maybe I was mistaken.
Let's see if we can take that out, maybe, since I think a lot of free time at the end of the day, at the end of the section. Can't hear. This was
yeah, that one, and then maybe like 10, 11, or 12. 12 try, maybe.
Okay. I'll try and just go through them. That's regular XML HTTP requests.
Yeah, I think it's only 12. See, there it is.
Okay. So, right. What he's done here is rather than defining an actual object called callback, he's defining like an anonymous object. This is the exact same thing, but he's just not giving a name to it. It's as equivalent to, you know, when we talk about...
Can you enlarge that?
Sorry?
Can you enlarge that?
Oh, sure. So this is the same thing as when we were talking about the Google Maps anonymous functions. Like, for example, when you do the geocoder, and then when the geocoder comes back, it calls that function you pass it, if you remember that. You can either give it an actual name of a function you declared above, or you can just write function brackets and then write the function right there. It's an inline anonymous function. So likewise, this is an anonymous object, but it means the same thing.
Now, could you extend that to have a fail in the same parentheses? How would that syntax look?
Yep, that would be success handler comma, so it would look like this. Maybe the same thing, or handler 2 or something.
Right.
Just like that. It's actually the same as what we had on our own page. The difference here being that we just added line breaks to make it more readable. But it's actually the same thing. If you got rid of the line breaks here, it would look the same.
You have a comma at the end of that one.
Yeah, so that's actually kind of a quirk. You can do this in C as well. Even though there's no next element, we can still put a comma there. And it's actually kind of good practice to do this, because I find that if I don't do this, every single time I come back to a variable like this to add a new thing to the bottom of it, I forget to add the comma to the previous line. So this just means like you only ever have to add stuff on one line if you always remember to put the comma. And it doesn't care that there's no third thing. All right, so with the UE thoroughly explored, let's move on to our next example, which will be the Google way of doing it. So once again, rather than including those three UE files, we have to include our Google Maps API thing, which is the same as what you would have at the top of your actual page for project 3. You're just including maps.google.com maps, and then you have to give them your API key. And then we have the shortest JavaScript yet. So this is actually really cool and simple, but perhaps maybe slightly less powerful depending. So all we're doing here is, once again, when the form is submitted, we have quote, and set the URL to the same thing as we always have. And then we have this gdownload URL function, which takes only two things. First of all, the URL, which we just created up here. And then, once again, I've used an anonymous function. So likewise, if I wanted to, I could have function handler down here that just says alert data. But instead, I've written it anonymously. So gdownload URL is its second parameter takes some function that takes the parameter data and then does stuff with data. Does that look okay? So really, this is...
That's fine. Where does data come from?
So data, once again, is something that gdownloadURL internally finds out for us once the Ajax query comes back,
cool,
and then passes into the function under the name data. And again, to demonstrate that this works, there it is.
You could do data.responseText.
That's a good question. I would imagine that it will provide you with more data if you want. Let's check. Where is it?
This is in the... This is included with the Maps API, or do you need the Ajax API?
It's included with the Maps API. You don't actually need the Ajax API. Although I think it's in the Ajax API as well, most likely. Where was it? Try events. Oh, wait. Here it is. Okay. It sounds like it won't give you the regular data. It'll only give you the response text. So yeah, just as the text of the document is the first argument. So you can still treat that as response XML as long as you, if you know that it's XML to begin with, you can still parse it as XML and use it ordinarily. So this doesn't actually constrain you. But by default, it comes in as text, not as XML in this case. So for this incredible simplicity of being able to do everything in basically one line, you do sacrifice the fact that it won't be interpreted as XML for you automatically as it would have with XML with XHR.responseXML. So any other questions about this way of doing things. So question for you. Are there any downsides? You know, if this syntax is so great and so convenient, why might we ever not want to use it? Is there any kind of downside to this at all? As opposed to the standard way of doing it with just XHR.
I don't see any way to specify you want post.
I think... Yeah, you can actually do post. It's just extra stuff. The question mark means you don't need to provide it if you don't want to. So
okay.
Committed it here. You can still do post. I mean in general between this and UE. Or anything else that encapsulated this for us. So here we go.
You said it comes back as text by default?
Yeah.
So if you had something that is going to get altered, well, I mean, if you had C data element in your XML, wouldn't that mess it up?
No, it'd still be fine. You could still just parse it into XML the same way. I guess what I'm getting at in this day and age, no one ever thinks about. It's like everyone uses Gmail without a second thought. But the thing about this is that you're reliant on remote hosts for your page to work in this case. So suppose that your user is in China or something, and for whatever reason, Yahoo got blocked by China. But, you know, the Chinese government said ISPs can't connect to Yahoo. So now your page is broken. Even if you didn't actually use any data from Yahoo at all besides just, you know, the Google Maps or the UE API or didn't use any data from Google at all other than the Google Maps API, this page is going to break because this script needs to be loaded locally on the computer of the user who is coming to your page. And the second thing is overhead. So these files are pretty big. They're not just, you know, very simple gdownload URL and nothing else is in there. This is the entire Google Maps API you're including here. And likewise, the UE stuff, although UE Connections is more specific to AJAX, it's still bigger in terms of the stuff you need to include and process with your JavaScript interpreter than if you just did it the XHR way. So there are trade-offs here, but honestly, the convenience for you programming is much greater than any kind of downside in general, unless you have a very specific situation, like, for example, a user who might not be able to access Yahoo or access Google. I would ordinarily say just do it this way because it's easier and you're less likely to make a mistake. But nothing's free. So I just wanted to get that across. Okay. So last thing I want to talk about is JSON. Before I move on to that, any last-minute concerns about just AJAX in general or anything that people wanted to ask about at the beginning and I didn't end up covering?
So this won't, gdownload won't parse XML. Will it handle JSON?
Again, it'll just be returned to you as text. But
well,
in fact,
JSON, might as well
JSON is always text. So in fact, XML is also always text. But but I mean, both of them have to be parsed in some way, which I'll go into in a moment. But yeah, like, as long as your response isn't something really exotic, like an image or something, I don't even know if you can AJAX an image, this will work. Just you have to do a little bit more work on your own.
Cool.
Okay, so I thought what I would do is do the JSON example live, maybe, to just make it explicit how it works. Try my hand at doing what David always does. Okay, so create a new index4.html. And we'll do it there. So what we're going to be doing essentially is the exact same page we have here, but rather than getting the response as just a text, which is what we've been doing so far, we're going to get it as JSON and then parse it and do some interesting things with it. So let's also create quote2.php.
Really hard to see those colors.
Oh, yeah. See, I can't change the colors, but what can I do? Can we maybe turn off the lights at the front of the room?
Or really enlarge it sometimes helps.
Yeah, I'll try making it even bigger.
There you go.
Couldn't see it when David did it either.
That's pretty tough to see. Wow.
Can you not change the background page you're
on? Sorry?
Could you not change the color, the like theme on the page you're just on settings?
I can't change the text here because it's just like the Emacs defaults, and changing Emacs stuff is always a pain.
Can it be on a white background, though?
Because I can try. I can try doing it in the Emacs. But the problem is with that, the text won't be big. So the trade-off is either I can get large text with bad colors, or I can get small text with, you know, something on white. So
here's a select all, copy and paste in another editor.
Yeah, you can do it that way.
Cool.
Control on screen. Okay. So no nice syntax highlighting. That's kind of disappointing. All right, so here is quote1.php as it stands. So JSON is generally useful in what kind of situations? Why would you want to use JSON to return data? Why not just use XML like we always do?
It's cleaner and more efficient.
Yeah, I mean, it's just lighter weight, basically. First of all, it's easier to parse JSON than it is to parse XML because the rules are so much simpler for JSON. In fact, JSON stands for JavaScript Object Notation. So really what JSON is it's like some text that if you put it directly into JavaScript would create an object for you with certain attributes to it. So generally the reason you would use JSON instead of using XML is just when you have something that's very simple, you just want to return, say, a list of a few values with no kind of hierarchy to them. You don't want to deal with the difference between elements and attributes, stuff like that. So, for example, if you were doing Pizza ML, I would not recommend using JSON because that was a very hierarchical, structured menu document where you want to be able to differentiate between, say, attributes like price or, you know, the size of an item and element data and, you know, the relationship between them. But for this thing, what I'm about to do here, JSON is appropriate because it's just so simple that there's no reason to go through the trouble of creating XML for it and then having to, once again, deconstruct it on the JavaScript side. It's always a judgment call. There's no cut and dry way to say, you know, this is JSON, this should be XML. So anyway, so as it stands, the script gets this quote data and then prints it right here. And that's all. So suppose we wanted to do something else here. So let's say that Yahoo is very slow one day, Yahoo is very slow one day. And we're concerned that when our users get quotes, they might be delayed between the time they clicked get quote and the time the data actually came back. And they don't know how delayed it is. So it could be 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. You know, they're not sitting at their computer with the stopwatch checking. So we want to be able to tell them at what point this was created so that they can look at the current time, look at the time that the query actually happened and say, okay, I know how old this data is. So how do we do that? We can, rather than returning simply data one printed, first of all, let's say we get the current date as date. How does it go? MDY, I think, H colon I. So this is just a standard format, which is month, day, year, minutes, or rather hours, minutes. And now we have a date string and date. And then instead of doing this, we will set our price to data one, like so. So now we have our two values. And then what we can do is put them into a regular PHP array. So we'll say values equals array. Then we'll call the first thing date. And the second thing price. So up to this point, we have just an array called values, and it has two things in it. It's in an associative array that associates date with the date as a string, and price with price also as a string, presumably. And then what we can do is use the PHP function JSON encode. And now we'll have a JSON object. And then we can simply echo that. So let's try pasting this back in and seeing what comes out if we just visit the page normally. Presumably an error because I, whoops. There we go. Get our date as well. And we want to set this to price instead of just printing it. Okay. No enemy backspace. That's interesting. I'll do it with nano. Actually, I guess this is more legible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just do it this way then. No syntax highlighting, but that's fine. Okay, so assuming I haven't made any egregious errors, we visit quote2.php. Let me chmod that first. We should be able to, what does he call it? Symbol. Right, so, and here it is formatted as a JSON object. So, interesting things to note here is that the reason you're seeing these extra backslashes here is just that it's automatically escaped the forward slashes in the date for us. So if you recall, I specified the date as m/d/y here, and I'm not entirely sure why it feels the need to escape forward slashes, but it is. So, and then we just have the fact that date is associated with our date string, and then price is associated with the price string. And notice we have, again, these brackets with the comma. So this is, if you copied and pasted this into JavaScript and set something equal to it, it would be fine. You'd have a JavaScript object. That's all JSON is. But obviously, we don't want to make the user do that because that would be a really bad website. So what can we do instead of doing this? So as it turns out, there's a function in JavaScript called eval, which can take a string that contains some kind of JavaScript code and do stuff with it. So let's see. We can set our new variable called JSONResponse to eval. And then there's some magic here I'll explain in a moment. And then our data. So because eval actually just executes the code in data, we need to put these parentheses around it so that odd, what would you call them, interactions between this code and the data and anything outside don't cause your code to crash. It's just a weird property of JavaScript that if you don't include the parentheses, oddities can happen. Now, this is actually a very suboptimal way to do this because suppose that the server, which we're trusting not to do bad things to us, got taken over by a hacker somehow and data started being returned as some kind of nasty JavaScript that, you know, connects to remote servers and puts those MSXP antivirus 2009 ads with the virus on them onto your website, which it could do, right? Because it's just evaluating this data without looking at it. It's not verifying the source of the data at all. So in the next version of JavaScript included in, say, like Firefox 3.1, you'll actually be able to call, what is it? I think it's, instead of this, json.parse data like that. And that'll return the object in the same way. But currently, that's not supported by Firefox 3.0 or most browsers from what I understand. So you'll have to deal with eval for the moment. Once everyone gets up to speed and starts using browsers with this new implementation, it's much safer. So I recommend you switch to that. Anyway, so now we have this JSON response, and we can simply access the members of the JSON response with the same way you access anything in a JavaScript variable or a JavaScript object. So we can alert the price was plus JSON response.price as of plus JSON response.date. And that should do it. No, whoops, didn't you mod? Okay, so presumably I got an error. So this is a good learning experience because we can look at it with Firebug and see what went wrong. All right, what mistake did I make? Oh, come on, Nano. So Nano has this habit of putting line breaks in things that don't really need line breaks, which is why it's not recommended for any kind of language that actually cares about line breaks, which JavaScript does. So, oh, come on.
Up where it says symbol, is that backslash supposed to be there?
That's just Emacs' way of telling us that it breaks the line.
Oh, okay.
That's not actually a character that's in the file, I don't think. Yeah, let me fire up. This is, what? Yes, I do. Maybe I don't. Sorry about this. All my text editors seem to be failing. The best way to do this is actually to get a text editor that's capable of connecting via, say, SFTP to the server. And then you can open the files remotely and work on them in your own machine. So you can use the mouse, can copy and paste, do that sort of thing. There's various text editors that can do that. I think Notepad++ might be able to. Okay, so we'll fix this for real. There we go. No error so far. Oh, that's not good. So what doesn't it like about that? Let's try echo or just alerting data. Or we'll alert JSON response. Let's see what it thinks of that. I know you can't see what I'm typing, but all I did was have it alert JSON response as well. So I can look at the source after and show you what it's doing. Really? That's not right.
What, where did you put the,
Oh, I know what my mistake was. What were you going to say?
Are you querying the right file?
You're right, I'm not. I forgot to switch to quote two. That would do it. So see, even people who can be TS for a course like this is the development process. You know, you make dumb mistakes and then you figure out what they are and fix them. All right, so it's an object. And there we have it. Finally worked. So price was $15.62 as of the time we made this query. And if I wanted to demonstrate that the date is actually working, I could, you know, have PHP wait for 5 minutes or something before finally returning. And then you'd see that it was off 5 minutes from system time. But this is sufficient, I think. So that's all there really is to JSON. That's the beauty of it. It's incredibly simple.
So you have JSON encode, and I thought I saw JSON decode. Where does JSON decode come into play?
I don't actually have JSON decode anywhere because, again, if you wanted to use JSON decode, if you had something in PHP that was returning JSON to you...
Right, I didn't see it here. I saw it.
Oh, you saw it like elsewhere somewhere. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so suppose that, you know, so you're going to be using PHP to grab RSS, which is XML, in the project. Likewise, you could use PHP to grab some kind of JSON data if you knew of a page that returned data as a JSON object. And then you can use something like, you know, we could do array 2 equals JSON decode. What was it? JSON. And what that would do is create an associative array, array 2, that would look just like values.
So JSON decode it's in PHP, it's not in JavaScript.
Right. Yeah, it's just the inverse object.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
There's no, other than JSON parse, which will eventually, you know, be put in, there's no real JSON anything in JavaScript because JSON, all JSON is, again, is text that is the JavaScript representation of an object.
Yidoke.
So currently you call eval just so that it actually gets put into memory, and later you'll call JSON parse so it gets put into memory, but other than that, you don't need to encode or decode because it's native to JavaScript. All right, any other questions on how that worked? So maybe put the...
No questions or on that...
on the HTML or the PHP?
Whatever code. The PHP, I guess.
Okay.
And this may have been covered before, but the... This isn't really actually, but the if data does not equal false line.
Oh, here?
Like, yeah.
So what that's actually doing is... Handle is a file handle to this thing we just grabbed from Yahoo. And what you're saying is, first of all, you want to make sure handle isn't false. That is, you know, Yahoo didn't refuse the request for every reason.
Okay.
Then you use fgetcsv, and you again check the data isn't false, which is, if I recall, fgetcsv just returns false on error. So it's the same as in if you, you know, with C, you often check if something is null, or in many languages you check for null. Checking for false in this case is the same thing. Like if you went to php.net and looked at the return value of fgetcsv.
Well, that part, like, I think I get, but the second part of it, the and data, the first element of data equals NA?
Yeah, why does it look backwards?
Why isn't it not equal NA?
Well, here, why don't we look at this and see what it actually returns, and we can see why it's NA. Place.
I thought it.
Okay, I guess we'll open it in Excel, whatever. Actually, that was dumb.
That's cool.
Okay, so for whatever reason, I don't know the exact format, but whatever we asked for is supposed to return NA in the first field. I think if we look at the reference for, see, we're asking for E1, F equals E1 and L1, is that what that is? Let's see. Yahoo Finance, what would you call this? API?
Sorry, I thought he had said that it was, he had found out that it returns NA when it didn't work or something.
Apparently it returns NA when it does. I mean, that's the way the code is written. we can get to the bottom of it if look for a bit. Wish I knew where that list of
it seems return NA when it doesn't work or when there's no value in that spot. So it'll give you like a bunch of numbers in NAs in some of the cells if those cells aren't populating.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where to look for this off the top of my head, but basically all you need to get out of this is I think it's been posted on the forums. I'll try to track it down later. But what the code is saying is just, you know, for whatever reason, what we ask for E1 and L1, E1 is supposed to be NA, whatever E1 is.
Okay. I thought you weren't supposed to.
Oh, you know what? E1 might be like error 1. So maybe E1 is a field in which it returns errors. So if there's no errors, it means NA.
Oh, okay.
Just a complete wild guess, but since it's called E. So yeah, I mean, the generalized answer would be because the protocol or the API is that this should be NA if it succeeded.
I do have one question on probably something that you've been over before, and it's really sort of off topic to what we're doing right here. But when you get RSS back, you get a bunch of HTML with it. How do you chop out the section you need from a big HTML page? Like so you need stuff that's between I think. A href brackets, because you need an URL. And you need the title, which is text somewhere. So how do you look at that file and chop out the stuff you need?
So RSS feeds are just XML. So you do it the same way you did it in like PizzaML. Is you're looking at it, you need to know what the schema is, first of all. So visit the page yourself, look what the XML looks like, and then say, okay, if I want to get this element, this attribute, what do I need to do in like XPath or what have you? And then you just treat it as XML and break out the values you need in that way.
Cool.
Check for any online questions one last time. Nope. Looks like nothing. All right, so any last minute questions before we call it a day? All right, I guess one last comment I would like to make before we finish up is I've noticed that the volume of questions to help at CS75 and the forums has been pretty low. So this means one of two things. Either people are really getting the hang of this and, you know, all the hard work on the past few projects has paid off, which would be great, and I'm sure that's really rewarding to be doing it by yourself and not needing to ask questions because you've gotten the hang of looking the stuff up and debugging the errors. Or it means that people haven't really started yet, which is very dangerous because JavaScript is much harder to debug than PHP. The errors are much more mysterious, and it can be harder to pin down exactly where the error is happening. You know, JavaScript will just, if it hits an error, usually it'll just stop. It won't tell you why it hit the error, it won't tell you why it stopped, nor will it tell you where it stopped. So it's a real pain, and I encourage you, if you haven't, you know, import.csv, or like import is one thing, but if you haven't actually started working on the actual JavaScript of the map that gets the markers, definitely do that now, because it can be a real pain to debug, and you don't want to be doing it Sunday night before the project is due. So just my preachy warning, but I'm sure no one in this room has that problem. So okay, with that said, thanks for coming, and yeah, that's it for this week. So I'll see you one more time next week when we'll be talking about I'm not sure what. I don't know yet what David's going to be lecturing on, and good luck finishing up Project 3.